from stpcatalyst.com.
Hello, I'm Bill DeYoung. This is the Catalyst Sessions. I am so proud to welcome today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Bob Woodward, who needs no introduction, but there's one anyway. Bob, how are you today?
Good, and you? How are things in Florida?
We're getting through it, my friend. You know, about okay. The way you'd expect. Well, we're here obviously to talk about Rage, which is it your 19th book about American 20th. President?
20th. Yeah.
My goodness. And this one is a bestseller in the country right now, and there's loads to talk about. So if you don't mind, I'll get right to it. Bob, in 2018, you told me and probably a lot of other journalists who were asking you to compare this presidency to the Nixon presidency. I quote you, you said, "We're not there yet." So now I'm going to ask you today, are we there yet?
Nixon was a criminal president, and the evidence in his tapes was overwhelming, showed a kind of criminality which was, I think, stunning to everyone except Nixon, who knew it all and was there. In the case of Trump, criminality has not been proven on any level. There are lots of suspicions, lots of investigations. For instance, in this New York Times story about his taxes, which is a very important story telling us that Trump cut corners. Everyone raised their hands who didn't think Trump cut corners, even his most devoted supporters. So have you ever had any dealings with the IRS, Bill?
Can I just say, yeah, not on that level, of course.
Look, millions of people have, and the levels the IRS goes into your taxes first, if they are going to disallow something, they will make you pay what they said you owe plus interest, right? And then they may look at it and say, well, there's what they call civil fraud, which is a 50% penalty, or they may go to a criminal investigation. Trump has cut corners. As we know, the tax system is voluntary. You can file your tax return and say, oh yeah, I'm taking a $50,000 deduction for, you know, whatever, and they may challenge you and you may have to prove it, but once you take the deduction, it's really in the IRS's court. And so I think this is an important story about Trump's character. People are saying, oh, it really opens up a whole new level of examination. I think most people, even people who don't like Trump, are going to kind of say, well, this is between Trump and the IRS. Millions of people have been there. It's not criminal at this point. I think that's a big deal. But it may become one. I think, unfortunately, it takes the focus and the spotlight off the issues that matter to people. The virus, race relations, the Supreme Court, and what it's going to look like, and who's going to be on it, and the economy. So people are saying, oh, this is bad for Trump. It may turn out not to be. He'll just dismiss it tonight and say, oh yeah, that's what the IRS does. And no one's going to look into their own life and say, oh, how that comes out is going to really, in a significant way, change my life. In fact, it's not going to change it at all, where these other matters are at the central to our existence, I believe.
Well, surely the tax issue points to character. And I wanted to, you have a quote from George Kennan, in your book, which I thought might be appropriate here. You talk about the treacherous curtain of deference that comes down when someone is around high-level officials, especially presidents. And you make me think, especially with what you're saying now, that you know they should call this man the Teflon Don, because you're saying that it's conceivable that this tax revelation won't matter. That the people who think
that's right. And what Biden is likely to do is take the bait and talk a lot about taxes. And Trump is on much stronger ground to defend himself, because it's a dispute with the IRS, who hasn't had one. And on the virus, the economy, race relations, and the issue of the Supreme Court, that really does affect lives. Tell me what's going to happen in those four things, and we'll know something really, really important about our country. Tell me what's going to happen in Trump's tax matter, and I don't think so. Now, it's a very strong story. It raises all kinds of questions about the debt he has. $400 million, that seems like a lot of money. If you're in the real estate business, it may not be as much as we think. If Trump is, what's Trump worth? Is it $1 billion? Is it zero? Is it negative? Is it $4 billion? If he's worth $4 billion, as some people think, being in debt $400 million is not unreasonable. It would be for you or me. We'd be traumatized. We wouldn't even know how to function. But for somebody in the real estate business, it's quite common, I think. I know.
Well, notwithstanding, the obvious question, my friend, which I think you've been asked in every interview you've done, after Fear came out and in the climate that we're in, why did, in your view, why did he agree to talk to you on the record for this book?
Well, first of all, what happened is a number of people who worked for him, when Fear came out, Trump denounced it as fiction, that I'm a Democratic operative. A number of people went to him and said, look, this is all true. And it's all true. Oh, okay. Well, he doesn't really read books, I don't think, though he claims he had read the recent one, Rage. And so he agreed to talk, and I had time to prepare questions, but he would call me spontaneously at night, so I had to carry a little tape recorder around in my pocket, have one by the side of my bed and one in the kitchen and one in my office. And he would call out of the blue, just checking in. And then he'd say, I can't talk long. But then sometimes he'd talk 20 minutes, 40 minutes, being able to prepare questions and ask about the matters that were in the news, like Black Lives Matter, which surfaced very, very strongly after George Floyd was killed. That was May 25th. So I was able to ask Trump about that. And when I did, we played the audio of this. I said, do you understand we are people of white privilege? Black people have an anger and pain, and Trump just mocked me and said, oh, boy, you're drinking the Kool-Aid. You really
listen to you. Boy, you drank the Kool-Aid. I remember that part. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but the tone of it, what's the tone of it, Bill?
He's mocking you. It's
mocking me. And, he said, I don't feel that at all. Well, here he's dismissing a very reasonable presentation about what the whole racial unrest issue is in the country, and he dismisses it and mocks me, which he's entitled. That's fine. He should be able to do that.
Sure.
but it tells you where he's coming from.
He's got to know, though, that his words are going to reach the people of the country and the world. As a reader, it was impossible to separate from views that a lot of people have. I can't talk about myself, obviously, but that he's completely in denial, that he has no idea what's going on.
But remember, when Rage first came out a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, he said it's a political hit job. Then he said he read the book in one night and it's boring. But then he was asked by a Fox News anchor, is it accurate? And Trump said, it's okay, it's fine. And then he started saying, speaking of himself, Trump said, I say some great things in that book. I let him have his say. And if you read through it, I mean, you see, he does have his say. And I think that's my responsibility, if you will, to make sure he does, but also point out when he says things that just are untrue. For instance, he said he's done more for black people than anyone except maybe Abraham Lincoln. I point out Lyndon Johnson, remember the civil rights movement and all that Johnson did. You can't dismiss that. And Trump is fixated on the economic unemployment numbers of black people before the virus. It's not good now, to say the least. And he claims, again, this is one of these sweeping assertions, which we know he's famous for, said, well, I'm bringing everything back. The numbers are going to turn around. And by the third quarter, which we're now in, economic quarter, or finished, I mean, he's saying great miraculous things are going to happen. You think that's the case in Florida, Bill?
No. When we talked before, you've always talked about, you know, the impartiality of journalists as your role, and I'm reporting. There is a noticeable shift in tone in this book to where you do pass the occasional judgment. I mean, I'm thinking about where and I'm paraphrasing, where he talks about world leaders, and he says, the bad ones seem to like me best, and I don't understand why. And then you kind of say, well, I thought, I know why. You know,
I say that in the book, but I didn't say it, that particular statement to him. Well, it's obvious why
nevertheless, sure it is.
I mean, he believes and he lays it out more starkly in that comment. Look, in other books, I have passed judgment, called Nixon regularly a criminal, said that George W. Bush, the third book I did on him, State of Denial, that Bush failed repeatedly to tell the country how bad things were in Iraq. In the case of Obama, when I did a book about called The Price of Politics, about the budget negotiations between Obama and the Republicans, which, by the way, were led mostly by Vice President Biden, I said just outright, Obama, one of his failings was he did not figure out how to work his will in Washington. He was standoffish from. So, and on the first Trump book, I said, there is a nervous breakdown of the executive branch. Here, the last line of this book is my conclusion that Trump is the wrong man for the job. That grows out of an overwhelming accumulation of evidence from sources, from diaries, from documents, and from Trump's own words. So I thought about that, interested, and I had typed it out just kind of as I was doing the epilogue, and I realized this is hopefully a book about truth, and when you get to the truth of what my conclusion is, I think I can't duck it, and I refuse, quite honestly, to join the ranks of many Republican senators who will say privately that Trump is the wrong man for the job, but will not say so publicly. And I do not want to join the ranks of the silent who won't face up to what the overwhelming evidence is right before us, particularly on the mishandling and the denial of the virus. I mean, the virus is not going away. It's probably going to get worse. People are forecasting a fall that is going to be kind of a health crisis like we've never seen before, even in the first months of the virus in this country. So I reached that conclusion, consulted my wife, Elsa, my assistants, the publisher, CEO of Simon & Schuster, which published Rage, and they said it's completely supported. I feel it's completely supported. And quite frankly, the idea of getting in line with all of those people who are just silent was unacceptable to me. And I think you can still be factual, be a journalist, as Trump said. He says lots of great things in the book because I quote him saying those things that he thinks are great. So I'm pretty comfortable with saying what I really believed.
Well, consistently in the book, there are places where I sense that you, as our narrator, as the one who's taking us down this particular rabbit hole, if you will, that you're sort of saying, well, you know, for example, during the early days of the virus, re-election was all they're thinking about. It's sort of, you make the conclusions for us, but it,
no, I don't. Like in
it's very
case,
obvious.
I quote Tony Fauci, the head of infectious diseases in this country, the face of public health, really. I quote him in the book saying, and he had all these meetings with Trump. He said, for Trump, the only goal was re-election. That's not my conclusion. That's Fauci's conclusion.
Okay.
And I quote other people saying things like Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, in the first 2 years saying that Trump's problem is he's not giving Mattis any guidance, so Mattis had to run the Pentagon as he saw fit. Mattis makes some very severe judgments about Trump. And one after an NSC meeting, Mattis and Dan Coats, the head of intelligence, director of national intelligence, are talking. Yeah. And they're talking about, you know, what if we got ourselves into what's going on here? And Coates says, or Mattis says, very openly said, and I think this is significant, he said, the president has no moral compass. And then Coates says, the president, Trump, does not know the difference between a lie and the truth. So the voices are the voices of the participants in all of this, including Trump. But you're right, I do inject some conclusions, and I've stated to you
where those
reasons for doing
that. Where do those comments come from, sir, like from Mattis and Coates and from Fauci? Are these different sources? Did you speak with them? Are they from letters?
It's a good question. I'm not going to those sources I have not identified where it came from. I quote them verbatim, and no one has, to my knowledge, disputed a word in the book, including Trump. And so I'm confident about the sourcing of that, but as always, I protect where I got information, but I would not quote people unless I had very, very, you know, sources that are authoritative, yeah, witnesses, participants, or the person himself or herself.
Well, again, as you say, no one's come out and said, I never said that. That didn't happen. Nobody's come out and denied
it. But, you know, it may, and on other books, people have come out and said things didn't happen. And then as time has gone by, the memoirs come out and the documents and so forth. And, oh, yeah, they did say that. So denial sometimes is authentication of your work. During the Watergate period, Bernstein and I would say, okay, got to, what we believe is a good story here. All we need is the White House denial to give it the authority that we want, because they would just get up and deny things that were quite evident to us. Here's the question: is he's now running for re-election? Who is he? What's at the core of him? And then the second question is, what's he going to do? What is the problem? I kept asking him, and it's in the book, said, okay, somebody who may want to vote for you, what's in it for them? What are you going to do? And he says, well, just do the right thing, do more of the same. And I think there's a kind of blank slate quality to some of this. I'll do well. I'll do what's right.
It's what you call the vague, directionless nature of his comments, which I thought was so good. He rambles. He recites his accomplishments over and over again, incessantly. He's adept at dodging questions and going off in different directions. I mean, did you feel like you ever had control of the interviews?
Well, you never control, but what I found interesting and important is he would let me push him, and talked last month, he called me to see if I could get something in the book about the Israeli UAE peace agreement, which is a big deal. And I said, the book is closed. It's done. And then I turned to the virus issue again. And he said, well, you think the election's going to be about the virus? And I said, not the economy. And I said, well, the virus and the economy are related, as you know. And he said, well, a little bit. And I, in shock, I think this audio has been released, said a little bit. And he said, well, no, yes, they're related. So I was able to push him, and some people who've worked for him and work for him now have even said, because of the nature of the relationship, I wasn't working for him. I could push him in a way that maybe the White House staff cannot in many cases.
Can you see another book in this? You know, he says that we'll do another book, Bob. And since he hasn't actually condemned this, do you see another one down the line somewhere with him?
You know, as he always says, one of Trump's favorite lines is, we'll see.
So I don't know what else to say. Thank you so very much for joining us. And have a wonderful debate day, huh?
Yes. We'll see.
You going to watch tonight?
Yeah, of course. Good seeing you. Thanks so much.
See you, Bob.
From stpcatalyst.com.